The following audio drama is rated PG for parental guidance. You should experience lots of explosions with no body parts. Parents should be ready to cover their ears.
They don't appear to be
This is a Look and See audio production, where entertainment is always free.
Time for the Broken Sea Audio Production OTR Swag Cast.
Hello there. You might be aware that as an actor, I've become associated almost entirely with what are known as horror movies. Personally, I don't think that description is quite adequate. I prefer to think of them purely and simply as fantasies, because they are, you know. They just couldn't happen, however vivid your imagination might be. In fact, there are far more macabre or even horrific events happening all around us every day of our lives, but we're just not aware of them. On my travels making movies in all parts of the world, men and women from various walks of life somehow always seem to manage to seek me out and to tell me their own strange experiences, and sometimes even I've been present when some of these frightening events have actually occurred. And now here I am with an opportunity to tell you a few of these stories, sometimes horrific, sometimes with a macabre sense of humor, but always, I promise you, containing the element of fear. And I've titled them, if you'll pardon the liberty, The Price of Fear.
The Price of Fear. Brought to you by Vincent Price.
Hello there. Do you like fish? To eat, I mean, not to look at or catch. Well, I do. I am, in fact, one of the world's most compulsive piscivores. I find there is an almost ritual purity about fish. The Japanese, you know, eat their fish raw, shredding and flaking the flesh and dipping it into piquant sauces, soya, horseradish, that sort of thing. The effect can be delicious. A delicate point and counterpoint, air and descant, plucking at the palate. The taste can be exquisite. And yet if you should think too hard about those raw, gelatinous strips of fish, you may find the feel of them, the sight of them even, is somehow obscene. But then my attitude in these matters is colored by a most unnerving experience I underwent in Australia. I'll call this story simply Fish, because as each stage of the episode unfolded, it was impressed on my memory by some piscatorial piece of gastronomic delight. It started in a Sydney restaurant about 5 years ago, with a dozen of the celebrated rock oysters with lemon and cayenne pepper and all the usual trimmings. I was lunching with a young Australian, Greg Rossmark, an aspiring actor who wanted to come to work in London. We were just debating whether another half dozen would be sheer bliss or pure greed when suddenly...
Vincent? It is Vincent, isn't it? Vincent Price?
Well, yes.
Jane Willemsey? I don't suppose you remember. But we did once actually work on a film together.
Well, yes, I believe I do remember.
It was a long time ago.
At Elstree, wasn't it?
That's right.
I strangled you.
Oh, what a charming fellow. Oh,
but I only strangle the nicest people. Sorry, Jane. Let me introduce you to Greg Rossmark. He's also an actor.
An eminently unsuccessful one. Hello.
How do you do?
Won't you join us?
No, thank you very much. I must be going.
Are you working over here now, Miss Willamsey? In the theatre, I mean?
Oh, no. No, the theatre gave me up for dead, right after Vincent strangled me.
Well, I can't believe that I was that realistic.
Well, it was probably just symbolic of something or other.
Don't you miss it, the theatre?
Maybe. But you can't have everything, can you?
Sure you won't join us, though. There seems so much we might talk about.
No, really, I can't. Richard's already waiting at the table, and he's due to start glowering any moment now.
Oh, that's a shame.
Look, how long are you here for?
Oh, just a week or so. I start filming in Hong Kong at the end of the month.
Why don't you come over to lunch with us on Sunday?
Well,
We're only over at Manly, and I'm a much better cook than I ever was an actress.
Well,
I'd love to come.
Oh.
Well, very well, then. We'll both come.
Oh, well, fine. Well, it's number 6, Sandy Avenue. It's right on the beach. You can't miss us.
All right, till Sunday, then.
Anytime after 12?
We'll be there. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lovely woman.
I do apologize, Vincent.
Whatever for?
Pawning in on your invitation like that, it obviously threw you.
Well, I suppose it did. I just wasn't expecting it somehow.
No, neither was she. I was trying to stampede you into accepting.
Well, you succeeded admirably. I don't see why, though.
Well, I thought that you were going to refuse.
Well, would that have been so disastrous?
Not to you, maybe, but it might have been to her.
But I don't see how it could have been. I haven't seen her for years, and I barely knew her even then.
Yes, I know, but there's just something about her. It's sort of difficult to put your finger on, but the eyes were out of phase with the voice. All the while she was talking, the eyes looked, they looked hunted.
Oh, come on, Greg, don't let your imagination run away with you.
Imagination be damned.
Imagination? What is imagination? A mental trick. A simple piece of sleight of mind that projects facts into fantasy, or fantasies into fact. Anyway, the following Sunday, Greg picked me up at my hotel and drove us out across the Sydney Harbour Bridge towards the North Shore and Manly.
The other day in the restaurant, Vincent, when Jane Willamsey introduced herself, did you really remember her right off, like that?
Yes, she wasn't the sort of woman you'd forget easily, especially after her performance in that film.
Was she good?
In it, very good. On it, positively scandalous.
Are you serious?
Oh, yes, quite literally so. She brought the picture to a grinding halt about halfway through the schedule.
Well, how'd she manage that?
She ran off with the director. Oh, yes, she took off just like that. Left us, her husband, everybody, flat and just took off. Believe me, it was no laughing matter.
Oh, it couldn't have been.
Well, at least it wasn't at that time. We had to get a new director in and a new lady for me to strangle. And we reshot every scene that Jane had been in. Oh, it was an absolute nightmare.
And what happened to her, Jane?
Well, she just disappeared. They both did. Off the set, out of the business, off the face of the earth, for all I knew. Her husband hired some inquiry agents to find them, and for a few weeks we were all up to our ears in private eyes. I sometimes wonder why he bothered. It could hardly have come as a surprise to him, not with a woman like that.
A woman like, what?
Well, she was younger then, of course, a lot more arrogant. She seemed to generate a sort of, sexual electricity. She had an almost animal magnetism that could devastate a man.
I'll tell you something, Vincent.
What?
She still got it. I wonder what her husband's like.
Well, more important, I wonder if he's a film director. or even an ex-film director.
I guess we'll soon find out.
We did, and he wasn't a film director. Jane's husband turned out to be a broker on the Sydney Stock Exchange. But even that turned out to be more of a sideline. His real occupation was swimming, surfing, yachting, all the classic activities of the professional outdoor type. Richard was a good outdoor cook, too. And what he could do with an open fire was beyond belief.
It's coming on nicely. Won't be long, Benson.
You always eat al fresco like this, Richard?
We only make a thing of it at the weekend.
Well, I can think of worse ways of passing the time.
A race, you back!
Right, you're on!
Come on!
Nice to see Jane enjoying herself so much.
Oh, God! I'm exhausted.
Well, I'm not surprised. The surf takes it out of you. Especially when you're not used to it.
Greg was... He was teaching me to ride the surf.
Yes, I saw.
Greg, what's that mark on you?
What? Where?
Out there on your leg.
That's a birthmark.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right. It's almost a family crest. Oh. It occurs at least once in every generation in our family.
What, always in the same place?
No, but it's usually on an arm or a leg somewhere, and it's always, but always, the same shape.
What?
You see? An open rose.
Oh, yes. Now you pointed out, it is like a rose.
My uncle, my grandfather, theirs were identical.
That's extraordinary. How far does that go back?
Well, you see, my family's name is Rosmark. I suppose originally it was Rosemark, but, God knows when that started.
Yeah.
Well, that really does smell delicious, Richard.
It's coming on.
What is it inside the tin foil, I mean?
It's a whole baked tie.
Is that that fish that looked like a snapper?
In fact, it is a snapper, but I always call it Thai if I'm doing a Japanese style. There's no great difference anyway.
I thought the Japanese always ate their fish raw.
This is one case where they don't.
It really is very good eating. Richard carves it off in great chunks, and you dip it in the shoyu sauce.
Well, I can hardly wait. Tell me, where on earth did you learn to cook food Japanese style, Richard? I find any style of cooking absolutely fascinating.
We were taught this by a party of Japanese stockbrokers that we took fishing.
What sort of fishing?
Tuna, barracuda, marlin, if you're lucky.
Oh, the big game bit, huh?
Richard has his own boat down the coast at Bermagui.
We charter it out most of the time, but we reserve a few odd weeks for ourselves.
You go fishing, Jane?
No.
He prefers to stay here.
I can imagine. It must be a far cry from Elstree to Bermagui.
Don't drag all that up, Rosmark, for Pete's sake.
Drag all what up?
The theatre, the bright lights and all that crap. She's much better off where she is. Aren't you, Jane?
Yes.
Did you two know each other before...
Before what?
Well, before Jane gave up the theater.
Why, yes, of course. I married her when she was still a drama student. And in the end, it was me who made her give it all up. Wasn't it, darling?
I could hardly believe it. This was the husband that she had left on her runaway romance. What could have happened? Had he found her, or had she come back to him? And what about the flyaway film director? What had happened to him? Well, when I got back to London, I mentioned his name around a few times to see if I got any response. I didn't. People remembered him, but no one had seen or heard of him since he had run off with that actress, as they put it. They'd both run off, of course, but only Jane had come back. I wondered, so dark a thought, it lodged unnoticed in the shadows of my memory until last year, when I went back to Australia, back to Sydney. Perhaps it was the same unnoticed thought that made me phone the one time Jane Willemsey and her husband and to invite them both to dinner. I remember the occasion well. We had a quite extraordinary Australian hock with a quite excellent lobster a la Morican.
How long will you be in Australia this time, Vincent?
Oh, only a few more days, and then I go to Japan for 8 weeks of filming. Might come back here after that, though, just for a short vacation trip.
Oh, well, then you must come up to stay with us in Brisbane. It'd be lovely to
Brisbane?
See you.
Brisbane?
Yes. Didn't Richard tell you?
But tell me what, Richard?
We're moving house.
To Brisbane?
Just outside, actually.
But why?
Richard has decided to retire.
Retire? That's a bit premature, Richard. Surely you must be at least 20
years.
Yes,
but there's no point in waiting till you're too old to enjoy yourself, is there now?
Well, what will you do in Brisbane?
Fish. Mostly.
I've sold my business interests here in Sydney and invested in a couple of boats. Powerful engines, properly fitted out. You know, chair, rods, harpoons, flotation barrels, a lot. We can take anything. Sailfish. Black marlin, and the big sharks, the tigers, and the great whites.
Yes, but why do you go all the way up to Brisbane? I mean, why not stay in Bermagui?
That was Richard's decision.
The charter rates are much higher up in Queensland.
Oh.
Better fishing all the year round, too.
Richard's going to skipper one of the boats himself.
Well, what will you do, Jane?
I'm sure there'll be a great deal to keep me occupied.
You'll probably enjoy it once you get settled in.
We'll see. Have you seen Greg?
Greg? Oh, Greg Rossmark, you mean. Now, did he ever go to London? You know, I gave him my address and everything and...
No, he didn't go.
Why not?
Well, who can tell with a bloke like that?
Have you seen anything of him recently?
No.
Yes.
Not recently.
How is he? Hi. Is he working?
No. He gave up the theater.
After dinner, I saw them to their car with a promise that I would visit them in Brisbane on my return from Japan. I watched them out of sight and turned to walk down to my hotel in the cool night air. Suddenly, I became quite chillingly aware that someone was walking almost at my shoulder, following me. I found myself looking for his reflection in the glass of the shop windows. I saw a suit that had once been smart, but the face was turned undeviatingly away from the reflection, looking no staring. I could feel it staring at me. The compulsion to run was overwhelming, but so was the feeling that he would run after me. I stopped. Suddenly, I had to turn and face him out.
Vincent. It is Vincent, isn't it? Vincent Price?
Yes.
Do you remember me? Greg. With the rose mark on his leg.
Greg Rossmark, of course, I hardly recognized you. Are you all right?
Let's just say that I'm sort of sick. You were with her, weren't you?
You mean Jane? Yes, I've just had dinner with her and Richard.
Yes, I saw you. Did she mention me?
Well, she said she hadn't seen you recently.
No. He won't let her, not since he found out.
Found out, huh? Well, is that why you never went to England?
Yes. It, happened again. You see, we, you wouldn't understand.
You mean you ran away together?
No. Everything but that, funnily enough. She wouldn't come with me. She was frightened.
Frightened of what?
Of him, of course. She's terrified of him. Then, when he found out about us, she refused to see me again. She sends my letters back unopened. Every time I phone, she bursts into tears and keeps saying, well, moaning, stay away, for God's sake. Stay away from me. Oh, the way she says it, it tears the heart out of you. And I know it's not what she wants to say, I can tell.
Greg, maybe she's right.
Oh, no, otherwise he wouldn't be taking her away from here, far away, where he thinks I won't follow. Well, he's wrong. You can tell him from me that he's wrong. I'll follow wherever he takes her. I'll follow to the ends of the earth, if need be. You tell her that, will you? To the ends of the earth. To the ends of the earth.
He shuffled off, backwards, into the night, until the shadow seemed to engulf him completely, leaving me with only the recollection of the desperation in his eyes and the strained emotion of his voice. As I turned into my hotel, I knew that I would need a vacation after my work in Japan had finished. Knew that I wanted to try my hand at big game fishing. And so, 9 weeks later, I found myself on the open patio of Jane and Rich's new house, eating homemade croissant and drinking fresh ground coffee in the pale sunshine of an early morning in Queensland.
Like some more coffee, Vincent?
Oh, please. And by the way, I congratulate you on your croissant. They're delicious.
I don't know how you can face the day with just that inside of you. It's a woman's breakfast.
Well, I certainly couldn't face a day at sea with a stomach full of bacon, sausage, eggs.
And tomato. Ooh. Don't forget the tomato. It keeps the corpuscles coming the right color. At least that's what my old granny used to say.
Well, mine said they gave you appendicitis.
Have you ever been fishing before, Vincent?
No, I never seem to have had the time. And I've never been convinced that I had the patience.
I know what you mean, but this is nothing like ordinary angling. You see, you don't just sit around and wait for the fish to come. You have to go out and look for them.
Well, you have to know where to look, presumably.
Well, I seem to know where to look for shark.
Richard's landed more sharks in the past fortnight than anyone can remember. He's making quite a name for himself.
What kind of sharks do you get in these waters?
Oh, all the worst sorts, or best sorts, according to your point of view. Tigers, mako, hammerheads. I've even taken a couple of whites. Small ones, of course, but even the small ones are man-eaters.
Well, what happens if you meet a big one?
Then you've got a fight on your hand. That could be real sport.
Yes.
Well, I'll just go and load up the car.
I'll give you a hand.
Richard'll see to it. You finish your coffee in peace.
You stay put. I know where everything goes.
Vincent,
What?
I don't know. I wanted to ask you something.
Ask.
Have you seen anything of Greg?
I saw him that night that I had dinner with you both in Sydney.
Not since then?
No. Why?
Did he say anything about me?
Well, he did say he'd follow you.
Follow me here?
Anywhere. To the ends of the earth. That's what he said.
Oh, God, no, not again.
What's the matter?
He's here. He's in Brisbane.
You've seen him?
Well, he phoned me.
When was that?
Nearly 3 weeks ago.
And you haven't heard from him since?
No. I told him to keep away, to go back to Sydney and forget me.
Well, perhaps he did.
Do you really think so?
Do you?
No.
Go on, Vincent. Time to get moving. Why didn't you come, Jane? It was only us two fishing. You could try your hand.
No, thanks. Anyway, I want to go into town today.
What for?
Well, you need more socks for a start. And maybe another shirt.
Oh. Yeah, okay. Drive carefully.
I will. Have a good day. You too, Vincent.
Have a good day. Have a good week. Have a good year. Have a good life. What does it mean? As if you can wish anything on anyone, or induce even the most marginal change in patterns of events that have been irrevocably precast in the unyielding concrete of too many yesterdays. A good day it was, then, in the sense that the sky was blue and the sun was warm and the swell of the ocean was at its most pacific. Good boat, and a good crew in the shape of Jack, a laconic ex-swagman from the Northern Territories. All it needed was good fish. I wish that had been all we'd got.
Patience, Mr. Price. That's what's needed out here.
But they're not biting today, Jack.
They will. They always do.
Give the bag another bang, Jack.
Righto.
What is that thing?
A dubby bag.
Dubby bag.
Yeah, just hang it over the side of the boat and it leaves a trail behind you for miles. As soon as anything finds it, it turns and follows it right onto the hook. At least that's the theory.
What have you got inside it?
It's what we call chum. That's a sort of a polite way of saying smelly bits of fish and meat and offal. Especially offal. Anything that'll lose blood and oil into the water.
Yuck. You're beginning to sound like a film I know.
Fish don't know that, do they? They just follow their noses.
Well, I wonder what'll turn up today.
Shark. That's all he seems to be interested
in. Well, he'll have to take what comes, though, won't he? I mean, he can't pick and choose.
Well, he does. At least he seems to.
Well, how can he? That's just not possible. You can't just whistle up which fish you want.
No, but you can take all the bait fish out of the dubby bag and just leave bloody meat in there. Then what you put into the water is not so much an oil slick as a blood trail. That'll bring the sharks running.
But you know, Jack, I don't understand this obsession of his with sharks. I really don't.
You can't say I do. Ah, they're not as good as marlin or sailfish. They don't have the heart. Remember the skipper set on fighting a big, great white.
Well, I only hope that's not a death wish.
We got a visitor, Jack.
What's that?
A big one.
Who? What is it?
Tiger. About 10 foot of him.
Oh.
Better get into the chair, Mr. Price.
Yes, sir. There we go. Right. Hurry up. He's circling for the strike.
Steady.
Yeah?
Here he comes.
Okay.
Now, let him run. He's only holding on to it yet.
Uh-huh.
Don't strike until he stops and starts to bite on it.
Right.
And strike hard, and don't stop to pick the daisies. I'll tell you when.
Okay.
He's slowed.
Wait for it.
Uh-huh.
He's turning. Now, hit him!
I got him this way a turn.
What happened?
The line broke.
Oh, what was the breaking strain on that line?
Around 1,000 pounds.
Oh.
That was some fish you had there, Vincent.
Shall I rig another hook?
Yeah, Jack, might as well.
Well, do you think he's still around?
Depends if he's still got the hook in him.
Hey! There he is.
Where?
Right under the stern.
Oh. What's he doing that for?
He's circling.
Why? We've got nothing else.
Here he comes.
He's going to attack the boat.
Hold on to something.
Boss, he's crazy. He's mad as a bloody meter.
Hey, get the harpoon.
I've got it. Get off. You crazy bastard. Get off.
What the hell was all that about?
Ooh.
I've never known that happen before.
Well, whatever it was, I'd prefer it not to happen again.
Struth. He was after the dubby bag.
What?
See for yourself.
We looked over the stern of the boat. The shark had indeed attacked the dubby bag. He'd torn over half of it away from its rope. The gristly, gory bait, or chum, as Jack called it, was already dispersing through the water. And then I saw the canvas, a shredded piece of the bag that had been torn away from the rest. It was floating precariously just below the surface of the water. On it was a piece of meat. A small piece of meat with a yellowish, bloodied skin. And on the skin was a mark. A distinctive mark in the shape of an open rose. Then the movement of the sea washed it off its canvas raft and committed it forever to the deep. Well, next time you eat fish, you may care to remember this little episode, but I hope it doesn't put you off. I'm still a committed piscivore, with the single exception that I will never, never eat fish and chips in Australia. Flake and chips, as they call it. It's a great favorite out there. But flake, of course, is shark meat. Goodbye. Bon appetit.
Now, from the makers of Coldwater Omo...
Find out who our latest visitor is, Barlow. You know how I hate to be disturbed.
Colonel Withers shot Mrs. Peel a significant glance. She took the hint and turned to follow Barlow from the lamp room of the lighthouse. At the head of the stairs, she paused.
So you didn't know Mr. Guthrie, Colonel?
That is correct.
Then I don't suppose you knew his friend Frederick Williams, either.
Probably not. You'd better ask Barlow.
You rely very much upon Barlow.
He deals with the trivialities, Mrs. Peel. Trivialities!
Thank you, Colonel.
Mrs. Peel left the Colonel and began the descent of the 365 stairs. Halfway down, she paused and looked out of the window. There was a lighted cigarette resting on the window ledge. Mrs. Peel noted that she wasn't alone on the spiral stairway. Then she heard it. The unmistakable sound of a gun being loaded. Mrs. Peel, without looking round, hurried on.
The Avengers. John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers.
Episode 5 of this story, in which John Steed and Mother are quite unaware of Mrs. Peel's impending fate, and how it is all done by mirrors. Mrs. Peel's investigations into the troubles at the Carmadoc Research Center had led her to the lighthouse on the cliffs. She'd been aware instantly of a strange atmosphere of distrust, and she was quite sure the place was connected with the sudden deaths that had taken place in the neighborhood. Colonel Withers had interviewed her in the lamp room at the top of the tower. He'd not been at all helpful, and Mrs. Peel had been more or less dismissed. Knowing she was being watched, with more calmness than she felt, Mrs. Peel descended to the base of the stairs to find that there was a new visitor, the girl she'd seen through the telescope.
I do hope I have arrived at the right time.
Well, you see that...
I've only
that
got the one suitcase, but it is rather heavy. 364, 365. Phew, done. I must say the year passes more quickly on the way down.
I really am sorry, Miss Marshall, but I don't think the Colonel will see
you. Of course the Colonel will see me, and of course I'm going to stay. I'd hardly arrive with all this stuff otherwise. Oh, I'm sorry. Perhaps you can help me. Can you make sense of it all? I'm Pandora Marshall. I arranged weeks ago to interview Colonel Withers. He agreed and asked me to stay here as his guest. He agreed to let me investigate all his developments.
Mrs. Peel has nothing to do with all this.
That's quite true, Miss Marshall. I'm a stranger here myself. Oh, then I...
The Colonel is a very busy man.
He didn't seem very busy when I left him.
Barlow glared at her. Emma Peel ignored the look and went on.
And he does seem inclined to forget things. He told me to ask you if you knew Mr. Williams. Oh, look, I'm sorry, but I'm getting nowhere fast. If I could just speak to Mr. Barlow. Oh, but you are. This is Mr. Barlow. Mr. Barlow? But surely I mean, you are the Mr. Barlow who wrote me this...
Pandora Marshall produced a letter from her rather large handbag.
You agreed to all the arrangements, to me staying here, meeting the Colonel. That is your signature, isn't it, Mr. Barlow?
Yes. Yes, of course it is. You really must forgive me. I'm afraid I owe an apology. I must be getting as forgetful as the Colonel. Kettridge...
Yes, Mr. Barlow?
Show Miss Marshall to one of our guest cabins. I'm awfully sorry.
Oh, that's all right. Mistakes can happen. When do I get to see the Colonel?
Just as soon as he's free. We'll get you settled in first.
Oh, very well. Goodbye, Miss Marshall. Goodbye. Oh, by the way, what line of business are you in? Well, it's not unlike yours. I investigate developments. Maybe we'll meet again. Goodbye for now.
Outside, in the sea air, Emma Peel paused by the side of her car and looked up at the tall granite building. Then she made a decision. She climbed into her car and drove along the cliff road towards the research station. Inside the lighthouse...
Is Miss Marshall safe in her guest room?
Yes, she's all right. What happens now?
I've spoken to the Colonel over the blower. He's coming down. We must hold an emergency meeting in his office here on the ground floor. There's got to be some quick thinking done, Kettridge. Some very quick thinking indeed.
But Miss Pandora Marshall wasn't as easy to fool as all that. She watched from the chink in the door of her room as the three men moved into an inner office. Then she slipped out and up the stairs with energy which would have made even Emma Peel raise an eyebrow in appreciation. She passed the spot where Emma had seen the lighted cigarette. It was no longer there. Eventually, she found the lamp room and gently opened the door.
No one here.
Pandora examined the room swiftly, then saw the telescope. She moved towards it, peered through it.
Powerful. Oh, there goes a car. Mrs. Peel's, I think. I wonder. Now, if what the Colonel says is true...
Pandora examined the tripod of the telescope more closely. There was a black box attached to one section. She opened it. Inside the box was a dial marked Activate, a speaking tube, a small receiving speaker, and a coil of flex with a distinctive-looking plug at one end.
Yes? Yes, it figures out all right. Now, where would this plug in?
It was the work of a moment to find a socket leading to the lamp itself, which, because of its distinctive shape, was obviously the right one. Pandora plugged in and switched on the Activate switch.
Now, find something, or somebody on the cliff, and I should be able to hear every word they say.
She peered down the telescope, focusing it on the cliff. She picked up two figures. They were Major Sparshot and Watney. They were standing next to an open car.
Totally baffling, Major Sparshot.
I'm not as convinced as you are, Watney.
The area was absolutely deserted, yet I heard voices.
Well, Mr. Watney, we went through these woods with a fine tooth comb.
Pandora adjusted the lens right onto the windscreen of Watney's car.
Now we'll see.
Oh, dear. Then we must have missed something very vital.
The glare from the lamp shone through the telescope and hit the driving mirror of the car. Pandora spoke into the speaking tube.
Boo.
Down on the cliffs, Watney wheeled round.
What the devil was that?
What the devil was what?
I thought I heard someone call out just behind
me. Oh, you're not hearing things again, are you? Come on, you need a drink.
There, surely you heard it.
Gulls crying overhead. Come on, I'm thirsty.
Sparshot persuaded the mystified Watney to get into the car and they drove away. Pandora smiled to herself as she swung the telescope back along the cliff road. She picked up yet another car. It was Mrs. Peel's. Mrs. Peel was checking the area, and like Watney and Sparshot, had found nothing. Pandora focused the telescope onto the windscreen of Emma's car and grabbed the speaking tube.
Mrs. Peel, don't be alarmed. I'm talking to you by means of a visual audio telescope from the lighthouse. There's something very funny going on. I knew it when I first arrived. You see, I've met the real Mr. Barlow before, and this one is not the same man at all. Mrs. Peel, can't you hear me?
Peering down the telescope, Pandora could tell that her message had not got through to Mrs. Peel at all. She hastily made several adjustments to the focusing. Down on the cliff's edge, Emma Peel was about to get into the car when she heard...
Mrs. Peel,
Of the devil? Who is it speaking?
Me, Pandora Marshall.
What? Where are you?
I'm here at the...
The message was cut off quite suddenly. The reason was that Barlow and Kettridge had returned to the lamp room. Kettridge placed a large hand over Pandora's mouth. He jammed a loaded gun into her ribs.
Don't move, or it'll be your last.
The activate switch. There, that's got it. Who are you trying to get at? I see. Mrs. Peel out there on the cliffs. Well, that might be a good idea at that. Mm-hmm. And she's calling someone on her car telephone. Switch on again. We may learn everything we want to know.
On the cliffs, Emma was indeed using the car telephone. She was calling Watney at the research center.
Hello? Hello, Watney. Can you hear me?
Yes, Mrs. Peel. Watney here. Where are you?
I'm out on the cliff head, on my way back from the lighthouse. There's something very, very funny going on.
What do you mean, funny?
Well, I thought I heard a voice. A voice out of thin air.
You heard it? Oh, that's great. It means I'm not mad. Hold on, Mrs. Peel. I'm coming out straight away.
I'll be waiting.
So you did get through to her, Miss Marshall.
I didn't tell her anything.
Kettridge, get downstairs. Get your motorcycle and get after the woman down there. I'll hold her. Try and lure her to the edge.
Right. Leave it to me.
Now listen.
Now you listen to me. Do everything I tell you. Repeat every word or else. Understand, Miss Marshall?
A short while after that, Mrs. Peel, waiting by her car for Watney, was again aware of a curious glare on the windscreen. It was then that she heard the cry again.
Help! Who are you? Where are you speaking from?
Please help me. Over here. The cliff edge.
But I can't see anyone.
Here. I'm over here. Please help me. Help!
I'm coming. Just keep calling.
Mrs. Peel, clearly thinking that Pandora must have fallen over the edge of the cliff and was clinging on somewhere below, made her way forward.
Please, I'm down here. This is me.
Suddenly, Kettridge appeared as though from nowhere. He roared his bike down the path, skidded it neatly at Emma Peel's feet. She fell backwards with a startled scream. She lost her balance, clutched wildly, but couldn't get a grip and toppled over the edge of the cliff.
Avengers. Listen every evening, Monday to Friday, to John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers, brought to you by the makers of Coldwater Omo.
Price of Fear, brought to you by Vincent Price.
Hello, welcome. This story, which I've called Soul Music, involved me purely by chance. Due to some slight technical failure, the non-stop flight I'd been booked on for filming commitments in Rome was diverted to Paris. And there in the refreshment lounge at Orly Airport, I met up again with Marianne. I spotted her several minutes before she saw me, but the recognition was as immediate as if the intervening years had never been. The same cool, poised awareness, even in that overcrowded, bustling setting. A kind of inner apartness. It would be difficult to describe. It made the frustrations of the flight, even the possibility of an overnight stop, only too worthwhile. The fact that her husband, the international violinist, David Clementis, was bound to be traveling with her, in music circles they had long been nicknamed the Inseparables, offered the opportunity of a double treat.
Oh, my dear Vincent, it's sweet of you to say so, but an overnight stop. What about that dreadful panic at the other end?
Oh, merci.
I can just picture it. Some hot-blooded Italian director tearing at his hair, foaming at the mouth, threatening death and destruction in all directions if you don't turn up on the next flight.
Oh, you've got it all wrong, Marianne. As a matter of fact, I took the precaution of giving myself a couple of days' leeway. Besides, from what I can gather, your hot-blooded Italian happens to be an alcoholic German who can't tell night from day and has been bucketing with rain for weeks in Rome. By the time they get around to my scenes, they could manage several remakes of War and Peace. Some cream?
Thank you.
Well, then, out with it. How's the maestro?
Oh, David's fine.
Well, more to the point, where's the maestro? Well, let's face it, the old crowd always referred to the two of you as the Inseparables.
The Inseparables? Oh, yes. Yes, they did, didn't they?
Now, don't tell me. You've got him lurking underneath the table. Stradivarius tuned and at the ready. Well, what's it to be, romance or a touch of Occhichogna?
Well, David came on ahead, an earlier flight.
Oh?
Well, no, nothing mysterious. Partly business agents, an impresario. Well, you know the whirl. Besides, he's never appeared in this particular hall before, and in violin circles it's got a reputation as a dead house. He suddenly got a bit jittery about the acoustics.
Typical David.
Huh?
Well, always the perfectionist.
Yes. Yes, he was, wasn't he?
He could tune up at the bottom of a mine shaft and still charm the birds off the trees.
Yes, he could, couldn't he?
Marianne, you all right?
Yeah, well, I'm fine. I'm just a bit tired, but I'm fine.
Global Air regret to announce the cancellation of their flight 108 to Rome, caused by a technical failure beyond their control.
Oh, I knew it. The damned wing has gone and fallen off again.
What, your flight?
Oh, yes, the inevitable dead duck.
Passengers are requested to report to the inquiry desk for details of overnight accommodation and alternative bookings for the continuation of their journey.
Well, that settles it, doesn't
Mesdames,
it?
Messieurs,
well, what could be nicer? A night on the town in gay Paris, all courtesy of good old Global Air. To begin with, you can wangle me a ticket for the maestro's concert, even if it does mean swinging from one of the chandeliers.
Oh, but
I insist, and afterwards I'll come backstage, whisk him away from the backslappers, and carry the pair of you off to a secret little bistro I've been saving in Montmartre. Food before decor. And just the three of us.
Oh, but surely, if you've got an early morning flight to catch...
Marianne, is anything the matter? It's almost as though you'd rather I stayed well clear.
No, it's nothing, really. Nothing in the world. It's really wonderful seeing you again.
You think the same will go for David?
David? Well, of course. Why should it be otherwise?
My ticket for the concert was waiting for me at the box office, as promised. The attendant handed it across coolly, no, almost contemptuously. I'd expected some kind of covering note from either Marianne or David, but there was none. I passed through the heavy velvet curtains and stood at the back of the circle. There was no usher to examine my ticket, but then there seemed little need. At a generous estimate, I reckon, the whole house could have been moved forward and still barely filled the front three rows. Their mild enthusiasm proved premature. Sufficient to say the performance was a travesty. The adverse notices completely justified. The bored restlessness of those who had ignored them and made the effort was unmistakable and totally vindicated. But it wasn't until the interval, grateful for my oversized cognac in the crush bar, that I tried to grasp the cause, the reason for what I'd just witnessed. I settled for one word, contempt. Contempt on the part of the soloist. It summed up his attitude and performance exactly. Even visually, the violinist at the center of this indifference was a grotesque of the David Clementis I remembered. The soloist whose charm and superlative talent had won hearts and critical acclaim in every major concert hall in the world. A veritable travesty of the immaculate, assured Clementis, whose famous profile even now stared out of the display cases that lined the walls. Contempt, not only for that fast diminishing audience, but for himself too, but most of all, contempt for that supreme talent that he had nurtured and that they had adulated for so long. But why? In God's name, why? I must have spoken the thought, because suddenly I was aware of Marianne standing beside me, but not the Marianne of the airport. Now she was making no attempt to hide the hurt, the need within her.
I'd hoped you might not come, that they might have found you a place on an earlier flight. But now that you have... Do you think I might have a cognac, too?
Oh, but of course. Encore un cognac.
Monsieur.
How long?
What, like this?
Mm.
A year or so after our marriage. In the early days, it seemed our love had made his talent flourish. But it wasn't till the pact had been signed and sealed, so to speak, that I began to notice the change.
But what could have changed him? Why?
No, look, let me ask the question. Now, before I came along, what would you have said was David's one love? The all-consuming passion, the reason for his very existence.
But what a strange way to put it.
The reason for his very existence.
Well, I suppose...
No, don't suppose. Admit it.
All right. His music.
His only love. It had possessed him from the very beginning, exclusively, uncompromisingly. He had no life beyond the rehearsal room or the concert platform. The demands made by this God-given talent was all that he'd known until we met and loved. And I taught him to share my world, of other interests, other people, other places, and therefore I displaced the total dedication, the exclusiveness of this talent. I broke the absolute stranglehold of whatever power had possessed him before.
Possessed? Why do you use the word possessed?
It's a strong word, isn't it?
Yes.
In the Dark Ages, they applied it to witches and warlocks and burned them at the stake, didn't they?
Mm.
You know, it's a word we hardly ever use now. We prefer to skirt the issue. But the talent David had possessed him as surely and as completely as any demon. The only difference was, in his case, there could be no exorcist. None. God knows we tried. But the talent had exclusive rights, you see. It possessed him from within, his very soul. And when I'm around, as long as I'm around, it destroys him from within and leaves him, well, the broken doll that you saw standing there tonight.
You know, Marianne, the ancient Egyptians believed that the soul was a very real, substantial thing. That it had an actual physical location, just like any other organ, the heart, the liver, the spleen. They tried to locate it, to preserve it, to sanctify and deify it in their Coptic jars.
A couple of thousand years on, and we're only too anxious to deny its very existence. But it's there, all right. In David's case, it's in his hands. The soul talent is locked in his two hands. in the fingers. That through his music can create a heaven or a hell. Not only for himself, but for anyone who dares to interfere with it or displace it. I tried, but I failed.
Failed? But you've done so much for him. How could you have failed?
Well, David admits it too. Just now you witnessed his public admission. As surely as any warlock suffering from the tortures of the Inquisition, waiting for the fires of hell to be lit and the agonies of hell to begin.
But if what you say is true...
Well, I know it to be. That's why I'm leaving him, Vincent.
Leaving him?
Don't you understand? I have no choice. I can't watch the doll dance. Not once, but over and over again. Open to the scorn and contempt of anyone who chooses to pay the price of admission. I can't afford to pay the price of admission anymore.
You desert him to this force?
It's his only chance. It's a fair exchange. My misery for the price of his salvation.
Well, I'd better get out.
No, don't go back. You needn't. He doesn't know you're here.
And if he did?
I know he'd not expect it.
But of course I'd damn well expect it, my love. A straightforward case of rally round the flag, isn't it, Vincent, old buddy?
Oh, you know, David, that...
Mark you, the ralliers are lying a bit thin on the ground this season, but then that's only to be expected, isn't it? Well, damn you, isn't it?
Oh, darling, there's no need.
There's every need. Oh, dear, the well seems to have run dry.
I'll ring through.
Well, the bar will be closed, but I'm sure if you were to try using your personal charms... Please, Marianne.
Very well, David.
You know we're splitting up, Marianne and myself. She told you we were?
Yes, David, she told me.
Yes, of course she did. But she probably told you it was her idea, not mine. A supreme personal sacrifice in the cause of art.
Something like that.
Not true. It was my idea. My decision.
I see.
Well, do you think I'd honestly swap a single moment of my life with Marianne for the existence I knew before? And for what now must take its place?
I don't know.
Well, take my word for it.
But, David, you still have the choice.
No choice. For Marianne's sake, you see, living with me is just not safe any longer. This force inside me is just not safe.
Why don't you try telling me about it?
Well, there have been several occasions, incidents.
I don't think I understand.
It's quite simple. A desire to hurt, to inflict. At first, simply with a gesture, a word, until...
Go on, David, tell me.
Until in London, about a month ago, there'd been a reception after the concert. Marianne was tired and came back early to the hotel. I remember getting back myself in the early hours of the morning. I went into the bedroom. I watched her sleeping there. And then, suddenly, my hands... God! My hands about her throat. Possessed. With a will, a volition, all of their own, pressing harder, harder, until, just as suddenly, it stopped. No hate anymore, only remorse. Remorse and the decision that it should never happen again, ever again. But it's still there, you see. In the hands... a force over which there can be no control.
And the alternative, if you choose not to accept it, not to release it?
Pain, certainly. And perhaps, ultimately, a hell beyond anything man has ever known. As the soul fights the body to get free, and the body fights back to imprison it. The pain of tearing as the soul tries to get out.
For what seemed an eternal moment, my friend studied the frail eloquence of his hands holding the tumbler. Then, with an inner force that seemed totally their own, they jerked convulsively. The crystal tumbler lay in a thousand razor-edged splinters at his feet. That, as it turned out, was to be my last meeting with David. And the next day I flew on to Rome. But I did hear from Marianne. We'd just finished some location sequences at a small fishing village when her letter arrived. There'd been a long delay in its forwarding, the postmark, Paris, a good month earlier. I opened it with an almost positive conviction of what I would find.
I know what a shock this will be to you. David collapsed as soon as we got back to the hotel that night. By the time we got him to the hospital, there was nothing to be done. I knew you were leaving for Italy the next day, or would have been in touch before this. God knows I needed a friendly shoulder to cry on. You will see from one of the clippings, the jury at the coroner's hearing recorded an open verdict. But I think we, anyway, know only too well there was a very real, if inexplicable, cause. Let it remain our secret. The price David paid for his unique talent was finally exacted in full, and in a manner so bizarre I find it impossible to embark on here. But if the final awful proof should interest you, and you are returning via Paris, please ring me at this number, and I will arrange a meeting with Dr. Emile Fouchard. I have already told him he may expect to hear from us, and that he is to hold nothing, I repeat, nothing, back. We owe you this. Besides, to know is to share. Marianne.
To know is to share. But to know what? To share what? What was it that eventually persuaded me to do exactly as Marianne asked? To ring her number, arrange an appointment, and finally find myself seated in the good doctor's surgery-come-consulting room just off the Rue Madeleine?
To hold nothing back. It's easily said, monsieur. But where does the knowing end and the disbelief begin?
Vincent, you have the right to know.
Well, the simple facts and findings related to my friend's death, they might prove as good a starting point as any.
The simple facts, eh? Eh bien, so be it. Here it is. As presented in testimony at the coroner's court, for which there is allowed no room for speculation or error. A summary of these facts, then. Several witnesses of your friend's collapse in the foyer of his hotel, his admission to the Hôpital de la Vierge on the Île de la Cité, the inescapable fact that he was pronounced dead on arrival, the admitting physician diagnosed heart failure brought about by blood clotting, brought about by an excessive consumption of alcohol.
I see.
And so I thought, did I?
I'm sorry?
I suspect that Madame omitted to inform you that during his stay in Paris, I acted as her late husband's physician.
No, it's true. I finally managed to persuade David he might benefit from some kind of treatment.
Though I must impress that without Madame's express instructions, I would not dream of discussing it with you now.
I appreciate that.
So be it. My initial examination of the patient was thorough and exhaustive. I gave it as my considered opinion that the root cause of Monsieur Clémenti's malady was mental rather than physical, which is why I used all my influence to be allowed to assist at the post-mortem. Vindication, vanity, call it what you will. Eventually it was achieved.
With Marianne Clémenti's consent.
Well, what possible reason could I have for not giving it?
If anything, I think Madame appreciated more than anyone the professional predicament I suddenly found myself in. Have you ever witnessed a post-mortem, monsieur?
Oh, no, no.
Then, if you are not of an over-squeamish disposition, I shall attempt to enlighten you. To begin with, then, to the casual observer, it is more an object lesson in butchery than surgery, rather the slaughterhouse than the operating theater. The instruments we employ, for the most part anyway, might be purchased in any quincaillerie, hardware shop, you know. The ultimate object of the exercise is to arrive at the vital organs, the brain, the heart, the lungs, the stomach and its contents, with the maximum of efficiency and the minimum of subtlety.
Yes, I understand.
To this end, then, hacksaw and cold chisel for the removal of the cranium cap, the ribs and the sternum, a scoop for the removal of the brain, a butcher's knife for pussing out the heart sac, the stomach and lung cavities. Some fresh air, perhaps.
Thank you.
A butcher's trade. So much offal to be removed, examined, disposed of, and then replaced with sufficient stuffing material as will persuade the bereaved relatives that their dear departed is as complete and unsullied as when he first came into our charge.
And as a result of this butchery?
We found nothing. Positively nothing that in any way affected my original opinion that the person I'd examined in this office not so many days before was as fit as anyone of his age, constitution, and occupation could be expected to be. Allow. Cause of death? Inconclusive. Consequence?
An open verdict.
And duly recorded for anyone to read.
Well, then what's the mystery?
Occurrences. Yes. Let us call them occurrences, the nature and reason for which we can only speculate.
Go on.
The cadaver of your late friend was placed in one of the wall cabinets with which every dissecting room is equipped. A kind of container, you understand, large enough to accommodate a corpse, but otherwise similar to the kind of filing cabinet you'd find among any office furnishing.
Yes, I understand.
I felt sure you would.
Well, and then?
The cabinet was locked.
Locked? Is that customary?
As I explained at the time to Madame, reserved mainly for celebrities, in view of the current excessive curiosity of the popular press. Just a precaution, you understand.
Yes.
On the very next day, a complaint from Monsieur Corbeau, the artist, was delivered by hand. The very next day.
Corbeau? But where does Corbeau come
into
it?
David had long ago agreed that Corbeau should one day be allowed to make a cast of his hands.
Oh.
But it was a long-standing, well, a life-standing agreement. When he read of David's death, he asked if I now had any reason to refuse that request.
And?
Well, no reason. In fact, it gave me a kind of comfort, a memento for posterity.
Doctor, you said Corbeau made a complaint.
Yes, within hours of the remains being put at his disposal.
I still have his letter, Vincent. Well, perhaps you'd like to read it for yourself.
Macabre. Grotesque. Satanic. Defilement. But what does he mean?
In that, too, you must judge for yourself. But first, I must stress that at no time, not right up until the locking of the cabinet, had we dissected or performed any pathological examination on the hands of the deceased. We had no reason to. They would have told us nothing. Some photographs. These taken before the cabinet was locked.
Yes, I see. Palm to palm. Total repose.
And these taken immediately after the complaint of Monsieur Kobo had been received.
To know is to share, Vincent.
You'd never have recognized them for hands. They'd been severed. No, they'd been torn away from the rest of the limb. Each joint cracked, the flesh bloated and pistulated, as though all the time, during the hell-like ritual of that post-mortem, as the surgeon butchers went about their casual ritual of carving, hacking, and scooping, the living soul captured within was screaming for escape. A living hell. To lie on a marble slab, eyes expressionless, unblinking, tongue mute, grotesquely protruding through the cavern of the larynx, simply lying there, knowing it, experiencing it, waiting only for the tortures of the hell to stop, for the chance finally to break free, and for the soul music to begin. To know is to share. I made my way back to the hotel. It was raining. At a corner, a street musician sawed forlornly away on his violin. He seemed surprised at the charity I dropped into his cap. But there was no joy in the tune he played.
Have a good evening, and come back again next week. This has been Bill Holwig from West Texas for Broken Sea Audio Productions. www.brokensea.com. Good evening. Good evening. The music for tonight's episode was composed by Brian Serafic Panopoli and Stevie Farnaby.